Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Dr. Deborah Bosley. Dr. Bosley is a professor, author, TEDx speaker, and founder of the Plain Language Group, where she and her team work with companies and government agencies to help them replace jargon, legalese, and other unnecessary content with content that is clear, concise, and credible. Because as she says, as consumers and listeners, we should be able to demand to understand the information that we are being presented with, which I love. And although a lot of her background and some of this conversation is going to focus around written and contract work, it really does apply directly to our conversations as well. I've had the chance to speak with her several times before, and I'm excited to finally have the opportunity to go even deeper into what she does and how we can all apply it to our important conversations. We're going to get into topics like the importance of speaking and writing in plain language. She's going to share specific strategies for how we can employ plain language. And yeah, we'll talk about the business and personal risks of not using plain language. And she's going to give us tons of example from her work throughout her career that we can all learn from and apply to our conversations, both written and verbal. So I'm really excited that you all took the time to be here today. Thank you so very much for listening again. You're likely familiar with our sponsors already. If you haven't, please head over to humantel.com, enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off the best in-class online training of your choice to learn how to detect when people's emotions are shifting by recognizing changes in their facial expressions and nonverbal communication. All you need to know is over there at humantel.com. For the professional interviewers, if you haven't already, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. to learn not just what it takes to be a member, but how you can contribute and what you'll learn from the International Association of Interviewers. And of course, while you're there, you can also learn what it takes to qualify for, obtain, and maintain your certified forensic interviewer designation. And while you're online, head over to inquasive.com. And that's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to customize for their senior leaders, sales teams, and HR teams to teach them how to unlock the everyday confessions hiding in all of their conversations. We really appreciate you being here week after week. Thank you very much for coming back this week. So now, without further ado, I introduce to you Dr. Deborah Bosley. Good morning, Deborah. It is so great to see you. Thank you for being here today. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for inviting me. I'm really looking forward to this.
Well, this is my pleasure. It really is. And people might not necessarily know or need to know, but you agreed to do this on a real quick turnaround. We just talked about this the other day, and here you are. So I really appreciate that, which speaks to your expertise and how much you enjoy sharing it. And I really do thank you for that. So as a little bit of backdrop, again, for people that may or may not be interested, we've recently shared a dinner table together with a group of people for the second time. And I am fascinated with the work that you do, because from my perspective, I feel like it lines up really well with some of the things that I do, and just trying to get people to relate to each other and to understand each other better. So without me robbing this entire conversation, I'd love to start by asking you, why is it so important that we communicate in plain language?
Okay, so let me start with a couple of things. The first is that my kind of mission statement, this is the passion that drives me, is I think people have a right to understand information that affects their lives. And far too much information, like your mortgage contract, your social security benefits, your health insurance, most of the very significant content that we have to interact with is written full of jargon, dense paragraphs, long sentences, so that truthfully, I do have a PhD, but that PhD doesn't help me necessarily understand the financial information I'm getting from my investment people, right? So people often think plain language is taking complex information and using proven writing and design strategies to make it easy for people to find what they're looking for, understand what they find, and take the appropriate action. So I've never heard anyone complain that something was too easy to understand. particularly in transactional documents. So this is my, I was a professor for 25 years teaching technical writing. When I retired, I had already started the plain language group, and it's introduced me to sectors far and wide, because every industry needs to learn how to communicate effectively with the public. And effectively means tell people what they need to know in clear, concise, and credible language, rather than telling them what you want to tell them. So in other words, we might look at a policy statement and we get a page and a half of just introductory material, when really, what do people want to know? What's covered? How do I, you know, report an incident, et cetera? So it gives people access to information that affects their lives.
You said so many powerful things in the opening salvo of this conversation. That sentence, it's early in the morning that we're having this conversation. That sentence, people have the right to understand the information that impacts their lives, is probably the most powerful thing I'm going to hear today, if not all week. It's so true, and often we don't think about it. So, and I know you're talking about writing and contracts, but it also, like, our day-to-day lives. I mean, even you talk about jargon, I feel like in business-to-business communication, whether we're in a business development role, we're negotiating, or even we're trying to train somebody new, oftentimes when we use jargon, maybe it's familiar to us, or maybe worse, it feeds our ego and makes us feel smart.
Well, there's some of that, of course,
But we risk making the other person embarrassed, confused, fracturing the relationships. I love a lot of things that you just said, but one of the things that I think I heard you say was clear, concise, and credible.
Correct.
When we think about building our credibility with how we communicate, how does being clear and concise enhance our credibility?
Well, there's a wonderful thing called the Edelman Trust Index, and it comes out every year. They do international research focused on a variety of topics in a variety of countries, but all around the issue of trust. And one of the, you know, pieces that I immediately grabbed is that people don't trust organizations that communicate to them using jargon. So your level of trust that your clients or customers or the person that you're talking to or writing to decreases as soon as you start using jargon, which includes acronyms and business speak, which and it's interesting. I've even been in situations where two attorneys disagreed over what a contract said. So sometimes even the people using the jargon don't necessarily communicate with each other. And I like to say, if you're communicating with another expert, have at it, although the jargon they use at Apple is probably not the same jargon they use at Microsoft, even though they're both tech companies. So it's more of a sense of building trust by making information accessible, as I said before. So interestingly enough, I will say it this way. People of my age have a tendency, if we read something we don't understand, I don't do this anymore, but of course, but people do, to make them sit, that they feel stupid, that somehow I'm not smart enough to understand this. There was a really important study done out of Stanford University with graduate students, smart, obviously, in the psychology department, but the psychologist was interested in how language affects human behavior. So what he did was take content and kind of ramped up the complexity of it, and then asked his grad students to respond, how did you feel about the information? Well, they didn't say, I felt stupid. They said, why would a writer give me this? Why would a company give me information that I can't understand? And their level of respect, because, you know, branding is a thing, of course, their level of respect diminished for the company and for the writer. So from our point of view, as people who, in quotes, translate complex information into easy to understand, it's the responsibility of the company and the writer to understand that the people you are communicating by and large do not speak Greek. You may be a really good speaker of Greek, but they don't. So how are you going to communicate with someone? You're going to eliminate the words that it's likely that they're not going to understand. And even when we try to do that, particularly in conversations, I have lots of meetings like this or podcasts or whatever, and the interviewer or the person, the client, will start using acronyms, just assuming that I'm going to understand what those are. And I have to stop them, and I do. And I say, what does that mean? So then now look at the time we've kind of wasted. Then I feel like, all right, now I have to take control of this conversation and tell them that something they said did not really register with me and why. So what we talk about is moving from, and Michael, honestly, we do much more work in the written content area than oral, but everything I say is appropriate for speaking as well, conversation. But we take the jargon of another industry and put it in front of this. So for instance, I did a presentation for the state government in Hawaii, and I used an example from medical field where a doctor said, if you take this medication, you will become obtunded and might experience whatever. And then I translated into bureaucrat ease, which has no humanity behind it whatsoever. And then finally, I said, if you take this medication, you might have a stomach ache and a headache, which is what we would want to hear in a doctor's. I mean, we might not want that to be the effect, side effect, but nevertheless, at least we understood it, right? As opposed to all the things that we sign on, you know, a regular basis that we truly don't understand. And then we have to hire a lawyer, or then the real estate agent, or then we screw up with our insurance, or, you know, there are multiple examples of how we all say, I agree, when in fact you didn't really understand it.
Yeah, and especially for me. I mean, sometimes I just look at it as, well, I don't really have a choice to sign this. If I want the phone, I've got to. If I want to live in the house, I've got to. If I want my truck fixed, I've got to. So seeing I don't realistically have a choice, I'm just going to sign it, which is terribly unfortunate, although I'm guilty. But you used a word in there that I want to call out, the humanity in the language.
Yes.
And I do believe, and maybe I'm a bit cynical sometimes, but I do believe that sometimes people write copy intentionally so others can't understand it.
I think sometimes, yes, I believe that. Yes.
Because maybe it makes me look like I'm smart, or I'm the expert, or I'm different, or maybe in a contract sense, it gives me enough room to work with that should this go bad, now that because nobody can understand it, I have ways to play with it in order to get to the outcome that I want. But to put that aside for a moment, if we just think about the average communication, maybe somebody is working in marketing, or maybe somebody is doing voter outreach, or maybe somebody's doing community work or business to business sales, leadership, any of these. When we're typing documents, when we're sending emails, or like you said, when we're speaking to each other, if we don't focus on what the other person needs to experience to take the action that we believe is appropriate in this situation, we're missing the boat.
Like, absolutely.
If we're doing something because it makes us feel smarter, better, stronger, cooler, then it's safe to assume it could likely make the other person feel the opposite.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Which is probably safe to assume it's counterproductive to what we're trying to achieve.
Absolutely. Because it says something about your brand, your customer experience, et cetera. So one of the areas that the reason I use the word humanity is because so much of what we do in terms of interacting with content is that we want the provider of that content to have our back. So if I get information from my investment people, I feel like my investment people have my back. But if they're writing or speaking to me in such a way that I don't understand it, then suddenly that human to human relationship you know, we're here to help, that friendliness, et cetera, just really vanishes. So I think it's really important to not sound like a bureaucrat, even if you use simple language. You always want to be in investing the humanity, the humanness. So one of the things we talk about with one of the strategies is to use we for the provider of the information and you as the consumer or the whatever. Because we and you and pronouns builds a relationship, right? So there are about 12 to 15 plain language strategies, all of which will take you from a highly complex document, if the attorneys are on board, because they're always a gatekeeper with written content anyway, it will take you from that complexity to, wow, okay, I'm going to actually read the rest of this because I'm not looking at a page with a thick paragraph and 40 words in a sentence. So I'm kind of wandering here. But so formatting is really important because the visual appeal of something helps the reader decide within like 5 seconds if they're going to bother to read something. Then I get clients who will say to me, well, nobody reads anything anymore anyway. So what does it matter? And then I'll say, well, because we've all been trained not to read these things because we've been trained that we're not going to understand it anyway. So why bother? And one more point I'll make while I'm thinking of it is there's lots of data on the amount of time that is wasted converted to dollars and the amount of dollars that are wasted and the amount of profit. If I could use an example, I did some work for an investment firm years ago, very well known. I prefer not to mention it, but we rewrote a letter. The purpose of the letter, this investment firm handles a lot of professors, scientists, physicians, et cetera. So they 401ks, et cetera. Anyway, they had written a letter to people who were reaching the age of 70 and a half. And when you reach that age, you have to take a minimum distribution option for your retirement. It's required. So in the opening sentence, so they sent the letter out that they had written, and within a week, they had clocked 10,000 phone calls from panicky readers or panicky investors, because the opening sentence says, according to the IRS, and that's about as far as people got. And honestly, the letter was really saying, hey, here's something you need to do. Give us a call. We'll help you figure out how to best take this option, et cetera. So they brought us in and we did some user testing. In other words, they had to watch people reading this letter and responding emotionally, by the way. We mm-hmm. read our emotions, we think logic, but it's emotions. And anyway, what happened, we revised the letter and what happened was that the calls coming forward were positive. They understood the material. So they were calling not to get the company to explain it, but to actually give them the help that the letter indicated. And then this is the like final cap. The woman who had hired me said, I'm not going to tell you how much, but the week after that we had sent out all of these letters, we got more than $1 million of new investments because the letter was friendly and helpful and because the call center also was friendly and helpful. And that built confidence, it builds trust, et cetera. So there's a monetary gain for corporations, and then there's a lack of a monetary loss for government agencies, et cetera. So all the way around, it's the better way to communicate.
For sure. And I feel like, if I'm being honest, I'm sure there's times I've been guilty of it. And if I took enough time, I could think about it. But I feel like there's too many times where we choose to use complicated, complex, overeducated language when it's entirely unnecessary.
Yes.
I worry that people feel like if I speak plain language, people won't realize how smart I am.
Yes. Yes.
But what we should be worried about, and with my investigations background, the word that keeps coming to mind as you talk about relationships and humanity and trust is rapport. And how can I build rapport with somebody if they don't understand the acronyms I'm using? I'm building a fence between us.
Yes.
Instead of building rapport. And when you talk about the, you know, the first line in the letter, the IRS says, or whatever it was, people react the strongest to what they observe first, based on the expectations and fears and previous experience they have.
Absolutely.
So the line that you said earlier that was so spot on is, what does the other person need to understand so they will take the action that you want?
Like, yes, exactly.
Just framing communication around that, written or oral, makes such a big difference. I certainly don't have the experience that you do at all on the, like, the documentation piece.
Yes.
But I worked with a software company. They brought me in to work with their mediation team, which I say in air quotes because they weren't mediating anything. It was just a name that somebody at the company decided they liked.
Sounds good.
But basically what happened was they found a whole bunch of people pirating their software. Okay. They decided that they didn't want them doing that. Okay. So they got with their legal department and had their legal department draft the letter. Not so okay. Yeah. People would receive the letter. And then this mediation team would wait like a couple of days and then call them and say, hey, I'm calling to follow up on this letter. Here are your options. And what happened was initially they cleared all the low hanging fruit. So the people that would comply did.
Yeah.
And then after that, nobody complied. And so they assumed that it was an issue with their mediation team, like what they were doing. And yeah, there were some opportunities there. But within the first probably 2 hours, when I called the break, I asked their VP, I'm like, hey, can I see that letter? And they kind of looked at me like, dude, I already like signed the stuff. I've been behind the scenes. Like, let me see the letter. Yeah. And it's a full page letter from lawyers that can be summed up as, you're a thief. We caught you stealing. You need to stop stealing. You need to buy our new product or we're going to sue you. Like, that's what it said.
Yes.
And he looks at me, he's like, that's not what it says. I'm like, that's exactly what it says.
Yeah.
There's no motivation to mediate here. This is a legal threat. So when your team calls, they're already so far on the defensive that, yes, we can work with your team here and we can give them new tools. But until that letter is changed, your team is playing against a stacked deck. Like, it's just, it's not helpful to the goal you say you're trying to achieve. And by the way, they hadn't sued anybody and they didn't intend on suing anybody. And once people start figuring that out, the letter doesn't mean anything anyway. Right. But that's just one example that I kind of overlaps with what you're talking about. So I am curious to ask, thrown accusations that people might use this type of language intentionally or to make themselves feel better. That's not always true. What are some warning signs or things that would help us recognize that we are using complex language unnecessarily and need to change? Like, are there alert signals we should be aware of?
I encourage people to read their original message out loud so they can hear it. And to imagine themselves at a cocktail party, or Warren Buffett famously said, you know, how would I explain this to my sister? So I'm not sure the warning signs are, not sure the warning signs are particularly easy for the internal people to recognize. But what happens is they get a lot of complaints. They get complaints from clients. They get complaints from customers. You know, the call-ins saying, I did, like with the investment thing, you know, I don't understand, or, oh my God, the IRS. So I think it takes the force of the public response. But I will say, thank goodness for this, there are a ton of regulations now that require the use of plain language. So, for example, in 2008, Dodd-Frank, in 2008, 300 companies were dinged by the SEC because they were not using plain language in a particular kind of financial document. So a lot of times it's the external pressure from the public or regulatory agencies that moves people to use plain language. As far as recognizing it yourself, try using it, that language, with someone who isn't part of your pod and wait 1.5 seconds for them to say, I don't understand what that word means. And this sort of movement toward plain language, even in academic and research areas. So in the EU, they passed a law that all clinical trial results must be written in plain language. So Pfizer and other pharmaceutical companies are following that, and they're now, you know, including what we call plain language summaries. I've also written and had published articles about the importance of academics and academia making their research known to the public by using plain language. So, I mean, it's a long-winded way to say, it's sort of like once you see a plain language version or once you hear a plain language version of what you're trying to say, it moves you away from that complexity.
I think listening to the feedback is a great answer. If I go into, I'm sort of stealing a line from a TV show, but if I go into, like, if my wife says, Mike, how was your day? Yeah. And I say, well, you know, I had 10 meetings today. Most of them went pretty well, but this one meeting I had, they really couldn't understand what I was saying. Maybe it's a them problem. I have to assume it's a me problem if I'm being, you know, real honest, but maybe it's a them problem. But if I go home and I say, babe, I had a ridiculously miserable and difficult day. I had 10 meetings today, and in 9 of them, they had no idea what I was saying.
Oh, that's a you problem, Mike.
Denominator. Like, now it has to be me, right? I was the only common denominator between all 9 meetings. So if we're getting a lot of, if a new document goes out and all of a sudden employees are saying, well, what the hell is this? If a new document goes out and now the customer complaints come up or the sales numbers shift drastically or prospects we thought we were going to turn into customers were not. Right. Like, as soon as those numbers start to multiply, we need to start looking backwards and saying, wait a minute, what changed to cause this? And it could very well be the language that we're using. So I think that that was actually a tremendous example to really pay attention to the feedback that we're getting, whether we view it as feedback or not, but how do the responses change? How do the interactions change in order to determine that our language is too complex?
Well, and I love the use of the word rapport earlier, which I'm going to use that word from now on.
Make it yours.
It's great. But, you know, I'm thinking about also body language. If I'm having a conversation with someone, you often can tell whether they understand it, or at least you're not getting that interaction that you would normally get when you're having a conversation where everybody's using sort of the same language, right? And so it really requires that you get outside of your own ego and focus on the person that you are speaking with and pick up on those body language messages, because that is giving you instant feedback. So in some ways, it's easier in a conversation to determine if someone understands you than if they're reading something you're not there, who knows. But paying attention to feedback is critical. And I want to jump back to something you said a little while ago, because you used all the words I use. So when I talk about audience, I use the acronym KEEN. You have to be aware of their knowledge, their experience, their education, their expectations, and their need. All of those things, plus the context in which they would be reading that information, because often, like in my family, I'm the one in charge of money. So hooray for me. That's a good position to be in. But I still have to explain to my husband what the insurance policy says. So not only do I have to understand it, I have to understand it well enough to explain it to someone else. And that happens multiple times in multiple situations where we're given information that we have to explain to someone else. If it's complicated, not only do I not understand it, but even if I kind of did, explaining it to someone else would be even more difficult. So, you know, and everyone who's listening to this podcast, if we were in a room together, I would say in the past week, if you've received any content that you did not understand, financial, medical, technological. If you had a conversation with anyone where they used acronyms and jargons you did not understand, raise your hand, and every hand in the room would go up. And then I say, and how did that make you feel? And they say, frustrated, I didn't trust them, angry, annoyed, wasting my time. So that emotional response creates a barrier immediately, like you were saying before with the word rapport. You have obliterated any rapport that you were trying to build with you, with the public or whomever your audience is. So we can report, that's one thing, but what we really want is rapport, not report. So,
and I'm stealing that. So now we have a fair swap. You're spot on. You're so correct. And I feel like to even double down on that, if I use language that breaks rapport, you don't understand it, you get frustrated, upset, embarrassed, whatever, then I could now get upset at you for feeling that way. So although it's a problem I created in order to avoid my own cognitive dissonance, I blame it on you. So I feel better. And we're just throwing logs on the fire and we're making this problem worse. One of the things that I try so hard to do, and I fail at it more frequently than I probably realize, is help people save face. And a huge part of helping them save face is not confusing them to begin with. But then when you do, try to take ownership of it and correct it as quickly as possible. And then you don't have to say, I'm sorry. Like, you don't have to make it sound like you made a mistake. But I think for me, one of the biggest in investigations we were taught, I mean, we weren't taught this in the same language, but we were taught to speak on their level and to build rapport and not to insult people and those kinds of things. But my having a young son has really like taught me in the most, I'm losing my words here now, but like in the most bright lights possible way has taught me the importance of speaking in plain language. Just earlier, I think it was, might have been last week, I was taking him to school in the morning. His school doesn't have school buses. And he was complaining about how my wife and I always make him do his extra credit work. Other kids don't do it. Why do I have to do it? It's extra credit work. And we, you know, there's no such thing as extra credit. If it's work at work, it gets done. It was a parent work ethic, all these things we're trying to build. Yes. And then he looks at me and, he says, but Dad, a lot of the other kids don't do it. And this might make you laugh. Without even thinking, I just said, well, Gabe, that's how we differentiate ourselves. To which Gabe instantly looks at me like my dog does when I tell my dog anything and says, Dad, what does differentiate mean? And I have to cover my mouth as I go, shit, how did I get myself into this? And now I got to explain this to a seven-year-old. But one of the things, I mean, and we work through it together, but another lesson that he taught me that I apply in my business life every day is I try is the operative word, to never ask him, do you know how to do this? Do you understand what I'm saying? Because he has to say yes, whether he does or doesn't. And this is just as true for adults as it is for kids. And so I try to ask, you know, when was the last time someone explained this to you? How long has it been since you've seen this? How long has it been since you've tried this? Who else? Who was the last person to tell you about this? Because all of that allows him to ask me for help without having to feel stupid or embarrassed.
Exactly.
So to your point, if we can read their body language, as soon as they make that, what did you just say, face?
Yeah.
Take a deep breath and just follow up. You're the technical writer in this conversation, not me. When people ask me about acronyms, one of the things I say, and I would love your feedback on this, is talk it like you would write. So I'm a CFI. Excellent. If I was writing the first time, I would write certified forensic interviewer with the CFI in parentheses. Yes. And then I can say CFI from here on out.
Fact.
So I would encourage people, and tell me how far wrong I am on this, but speak how you write. If you're going to use an acronym, it's the National Association of Plain Language Professionals. And now from now on, you can say NAP, whatever that would be. I just made that up.
Actually, for writing, we would do the opposite. Write it as you would speak it.
Okay.
Because we talk about conversational tone, that the language you use, would you stand in front of another human being and use that same language? So that's a really good point in terms of the acronyms and et cetera.
I got another question for you, if you don't mind me jumping in and interrupting you. I apologize.
No, you're just interrupting me because I couldn't think about what I was going to say. So fill in, Mike.
So when I was on your website doing some preparation / internet stalking, whatever you want to call it, prior to our conversation, I noticed that you had like a plain language checklist.
Yes.
And if I recall correctly, it had 15 numbers on it. And earlier you mentioned 12 to 15 plain language principles or guidelines. I might be using the wrong word here.
Strategies.
I apologize.
We use strategies. Yeah.
So if I'm making an assumption that there might be some overlap between those strategies in the checklist that I saw you had.
Oh,
so
sure.
I'm curious for people who are listening to you saying, okay, these are all good points. I get it. I need to start being more focused on using plain language, written or spoken. What are some of the most important, not all 15 necessarily, but what are some of the most important strategies that they can apply?
Okay, love to talk about this. Let me preface it by saying, if anyone listening goes to our website, theplainlanguagegroup.com, go to resources and you can download the checklist. So I'll talk about the ones that I think are most important, not in any particular order. Number one, use verbs, not nouns. So for all of us who have sort of forgotten some of that, what that means is, why say make a determination of when you can say determine? Why say we're going to do an evaluation of when you can say evaluate? So those verbs have action implied in them. So that's an easy thing for people to just notice. If you're using a lot of ION words, to make a determination, to do an evaluation, et cetera, just go for the verb. So that's one thing.
Love it.
Second thing is to use the active voice. So this is a problem, particularly with bureaucracies. So to remind us, from the fifth grade or whatever it was, the active voice is Jim sent the report. Now, many people would have written that the report was sent by Jim. So number one, if you're identifying the agent or the person taking the action by Jim, just pop him up at the beginning. Passive voice often either puts the person at the end or eliminates it. Bombs were dropped. There's a reason they say bombs were dropped, because the implication is you don't want to reveal who was responsible, right?
Now you're speaking like an investigator. I love it.
Well, I'm really fascinated with what you do. Psych, I'd love to be a fly on the wall and listen to the conversations. So use the active voice. Another really important element in plain language strategies is the use of short sentences. We research, again, everything I'm telling you is backed up by research, but research shows a couple of things. Number one, if you have a sentence that's 40, 45 words long, which is unfortunately not unusual, by the time readers get to the end, they literally may have forgotten what was the point and where did they start. So we want to keep people engaged throughout the reading of the content. So keep this you can do very easily as well, is keep your sentences under 20 words if possible. Better to have more sentences than it is to have fewer sentences, but they're so long, three of those sentences take up half a page of a paragraph. So the other thing is paragraphs. You want to have no more than 3 to 5 paragraphs on any page. Michael, I'm talking mostly about writing, some of this obviously I think is going to apply to oral, to oral audio speaking. You want no more than 3 to 5 paragraphs. So then you want white space so that the reader has time physically to take a breather between paragraphs, particularly if the information, again, is really critical. So short sentences, use the active voice, be concise. So again, when you do things like use the active voice, you immediately eliminate a lot of words, or you can find this online. What you'll find is a list of what we say or what we write and what we should write. So for example, at this point in time, just means now. Right? Let's see. In the amount of $12. No, $12. So look at the sentences and see what words do I really need to have and what words are just my habitual phrases that I've come to learn and use over time. So being more concise. Using positive language. So by the time a child is 5 years old, they have heard no or something negative, something like, 8,000 times. And we do it unconsciously. Like anytime I see an email where it says, please do not hesitate to call, I go, why don't you just say, feel free to call? There's so many situations in which we use negative words when actually we're trying to convey something positive. Ergo, so there you go, see? therefore, that was the differentiation that I just did. So here's a great quote. Communicate unto others as they would communicate unto themselves. What are the words, what are the concepts that the reader would use? And again, it kind of runs back. I think Dick Cavett had a funny little quote about, you know, would you really want to talk to somebody at a cocktail party if all they used was jargon? So, you know, so use the words that your reader is going to understand. Again, positive language, though. For example, if we were in a room together, I would say, do not remain seated. Okay, well, really, I'm just telling you to stand up. Although, if I say don't remain seated, somebody could lie down on the floor and they would be doing what I asked them to. Phrase things in the positive can be very helpful. Please do not close the door. No, please leave the door open. So one is an one is like a kind of a punitive, don't do this. The other is, hey, do it this way. So the use of positive voice. Also use visuals. So we process visual information, I think roughly 30% faster than we do text. So provide visuals that will help guide, whether it's a table, which I like to use a lot, particularly if you have a lot of numbers in a paragraph. You can often break down numbers and dates into a nice clean table of two or three columns and a few lines. And it also breaks up the density that you're working with or you're trying to get rid of. Okay, I'm trying to think.
Well, I think those were so many great examples. And I wish I met you before I wrote my book because so many things the editors told me I'm hearing from you. So I feel like we met about 4 years too late. It also ties into being a dad. You know, you talk about, please don't remain seated. They can stand up or lay down. I can't tell you how many times I feel like I gave my son clear directions. He does something else and I have to stop and go, that's on me. Like, I didn't say it right. He's actually doing what he believes I asked him to do. That's on me. I didn't make it clear enough. And I love listening to you too, as you're talking about like how to be more concise and use plain language, because from a different perspective, when I was taught a handful of different statement analysis techniques. So you've got people that might have been suspects, witnesses, victims in a situation. Sure. They all write statements. We get the statements. And in the statements, you know, you're not going to say, okay, this person's guilty. You're not going to do that anyway.
Right.
But you can start to break down how the statements are written to get a good idea of what's not being said and what were people's level of involvement and emotional state and all these things. And passive and active language was a big one we would look for. One of my all-time favorites is when somebody wrote, that's when the knife cut him. So it just jumped off the table, walked across the room and stuck it in his arm. Like that's what happened there. In short words or short sentences, excuse me. Like I remember being told once, if you can say something in 10 words or 6 words, why would you say it in 10 words when you can say it in six?
Exactly. So here's another kind of interesting example that actually happened to me. So when I was being a professor, you know, we get a certain amount of money to go to conferences and give papers. And the instruction said, you are not allowed to fly first class. Okay. but they didn't say anything about business class. So I went into the chair of the department and said, okay, does this mean I can fly business class? He said, oh, no, of course not. You can't. And I said, but why don't you just tell me you may only fly economy? And that eliminates the, you know, the other options that negative language often leaves open to people. So anyway, I think those are probably strategies that people could start thinking about and using. And I would suggest just pick one or two, maybe from the checklist as a reminder, pick one or two, work on that, then pick one or two and work on that. Because I'm really asking you, you played classical music all your life. I'm now asking you to play jazz. You know, it takes practice with feedback over time to change writing and speaking habits too. Mm-hmm. You know, sure, we do all this habitually.
For sure. And I'll provide a direct link in the show notes to that checklist.
Oh, good.
So people don't have to go hunting for it. I'll make sure that's in there. I know we're running up on time here and you are squeezing this into a very busy week. So I really appreciate it. I'd like to ask one question just for your kind of quick thoughts and insights. I know AI changes rapidly and different people have different opinions for it. I think I share yours, reading body language, especially as it relates to this particular conversation, I should say. But for people who might be thinking, okay, this all sounds great, this all makes sense, but I'll just put it into AI and let AI clean it up for me. I know I have some real concerns there. Maybe I shouldn't. But what thoughts do you have about people trusting AI to help them with the right plain language, as opposed to taking the time to really study their audience, the outcomes that they want, and be strategic about what they say and write?
Well, first of all, AI is not always correct. Mm-hmm. Secondly, AI plagiarizes everything. Third, you really need an AI is not particularly good with tone. And so you need an expert to read what's been generated by AI and make changes and figure out this is not correct, this is correct, et cetera, et cetera. So, but people are really like, oh my God, I'll never have to write again. Mm-hmm. So what I say for those people is use AI generated content as a first draft. Don't use it as a final product that you turn into the boss or whomever that proposal's going to. But you still have to know enough about the content to know when what AI gets wrong. So years ago, I did an internship at IBM, faculty internship, and the head of the IBM here in Charlotte said to me, well, you do realize that in 10 years, there'll be no books because this was all computer, right? So, you know, people say, well, in a few years, we won't need writers. No. There's a difference between a construction company and an architectural firm, right? AI can give you some of the materials, but it can't create that final version that really will be effective.
Yeah, I agree entirely. And I know we've got to wrap up here, but a funny example was I was in Florida maybe 2 years ago. No, it would have been last year, working with a group of clients. And one guy was laughing about AI. He plugged in, he wanted help writing a job description for somebody to work in a nursery.
Yeah.
And it came up with childcare.
Of course.
And he was talking about gardening and landscaping for his
business. Of course. So any human being would have known that difference, right?
Yeah, right. But the computer doesn't. So I could pick your brain for hours and I look forward to continuing our conversations. I truly do, but I know you got to run. So really quick, where can people go to look online to learn more about you, learn more about your company, connect with you? I know you do speaking engagements. Your team provides services to government agencies and companies and all different things. So for people who are looking to connect with you and learn more, where should they go?
Well, you can go to LinkedIn. Of course, I have a profile in LinkedIn, and then you could go to my website at theplainlanguagegroup.com. And you could actually feel free to email me at Deborah@theplainlanguagegroup.com. I'm more than happy if any of your listeners have questions. I'll be happy to respond to them.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
And sure. We'll thank you, Michael. There. I love this, and I love what you do. I want to pick your brain more about how you investigate. So
we'll do it.
Into language.
Yes, we will meet again soon. I promise.
Awesome. All right.
Travel safe. I really appreciate you making the time today. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Bye-bye.
Deborah, thank you so much for a great conversation. I truly appreciate your perspective. The work you do and the clients you've done it with is extremely impressive. And the lessons are so important to all of our conversations, whether it's within our own team and our businesses, whether it's communicating with our customers, even with our family at home. The power of plain language is so very important. And I absolutely love your quote. People have the right to understand the information that impacts their lives. So very true. And unfortunately, so many times we don't. Thank you so much for all you shared today. I love when we're having a conversation with somebody, the point you made that they should be able to understand what we're saying or what we're writing to the degree that they can take the action that we intend them to take based on the message we're contributing. It sounds basic, but it's so very important. And your idea to make sure that we're including humanity in all of our language is right on point. And I really do appreciate you sharing your time today, all of the lessons that you learned. And selfishly, I'm really excited to continue our conversations down the road. Hopefully everybody listening today took notes as well that can help them in all of their business and professional conversations. We really do appreciate all of you being here week after week for these shows. Thank you so very much. Before you go, please take a moment to like the show, share the show, subscribe to it so you know when the next one's coming out. Let us know your feedback. What would you like to hear more or less of? We would love to hear from all of you. Thank you. And of course, please check out our sponsors. Go over to humantel.com. That's where you can learn everything you need to know to start your education on identifying when people's emotions are shifting by identifying changes in their facial expressions and nonverbal communications. The code INQUASIVE25 will get you 25% off all of that online training. For the professional interviewers, certifiedinterviewer.com is the place to go. For all of the need-to-know information on joining and contributing to the International Association of Interviewers, as well as qualifying for, obtaining, and maintaining your Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. And while you're online, please head over to inquasive.com to learn more about the programs our clients ask us to customize and facilitate for their senior leaders, sales teams, and HR teams to teach them how to encourage people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences. As always, thank you so much for being here. We'll see you all again next week. Please stay safe and take care of each other.